Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we reserve the third Friday of the month on this program for your personal finance questions. And Kevin Waspy is back to take your calls and emails. Kevin is a CFA, a chartered financial analyst, and a lecturer with the University of Illinois College of Business. At least that's the job title, Kevin. What do you do with the university?
I teach finance classes. I'm a finance faculty member.
And to business students in particular, or do you get people from outside business majors?
We get a few non-business students, but they're predominantly business.
Kevin's here to answer your questions about investing, saving, and borrowing. And for those of you who get nervous about things like maintaining an investment portfolio, we'll be going over Kevin's couch potato portfolio later in the show. You can call in at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or check us out on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either site at Focus580. Good morning, Kevin. You know, I was looking at the news this week, and at Springfield they've been busy passing pension bills. The Senate has a couple, and the Illinois House has one, and who knows what's going to happen with them or how long it will take for the courts to decide what their impact is. But I know that especially here in the Champaign-Urbana or in the Charleston-Mattoon area, a lot of people are on state pension plans. And I'm just wondering, is for people who are mixing their own savings with what they're expecting from pensions, should they be on the lookout for any changes that might happen that might want them to change their financial picture?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would suppose at this point, at least in my reading of what has been proposed, that we still have a case where there are way too many unknowns as opposed to knowns. In a perfect world, and I don't mean perfect outside of each individual's control. I meant within the control every individual has over their own budget. In that perfect world, what happens with state retirement plans would not have a huge impact. It would certainly have an impact potentially, but should not have a huge impact. I've always advocated erring on the side of conservatism and being a little bit more prudent with our income than perhaps what we might do.
So it may not, even in the best of times, when the when a pension package looks the most secure, it may be a good idea to keep in mind that it might not be.
Yeah, the sad fact of the matter is we live in a very different world. Historically, a person that was covered by a defined benefit pension plan, a true pension plan, literally looked forward to a certain dollar and cents amount per month at time of retirement as a guarantee. And again, the world we live in today, even for those participants in the state plans where there is choice and they have chosen the defined benefit plans, we're finding that promises made by any entity certainly carry risk of being broken.
Well, I'm looking at the news accounts here of what's in these plans, and apparently the House bill that passed out of committee yesterday is very similar to the Senate bills. It would limit cost of living adjustments to pension benefits to the first $25,000 of a pension and then delay when those COLAs start, and then increase the employees' pension contributions by 2%. There's also a mechanism to force the state to make its required pension payments. We'll have to see how that works out. And the bill in the House also creates a new retirement approach for people who join either the state university's retirement system, also known as SERS, or the teacher's retirement system beginning next year. And this is a new approach that combines elements of a traditional defined benefit pension plan with elements of a 401k-style plan. And that brings up another question, because people who are starting a job with the state do have a choice of approaches now. Would you recommend one over the other, depending on what circumstances?
That's a good question. And I think the key in your question itself is it depends on the circumstances. For people that tend to look at their job as being a stepping stone in a career path, a defined contribution plan has always made more sense because it allows the accumulation of benefits in the form of contributions to move with them to next positions, next jobs, next employers. The defined benefit plans have been traditionally, at least, much more restrictive so that a benefit is earned from that plan, and the portability of it, historically at least, has been a lot less. So it is probably more important to look at a person's trajectory in their career plans when making that type of decision, even given what's going on today with DB plans.
If you're with the other type of plan and you move, you leave the state of Illinois system, what happens to your what happens to your pension benefits that have been building up?
Well, in the state of Illinois' State University Retirement Plan, SERS, as you refer to it, the plan that probably covers many people throughout Champaign-Urbana, Mattoon, Charleston, so on and so forth. Any employee of a state university or of a community college, a junior college, would be a participant in SERS. When they leave, even if they're in the defined benefit plan, they can take a lump sum distribution and move it either into another employer's retirement plan or into a self-directed IRA account, an IRA rollover. But the amount of money they would be moving could be severely, lessened based on their age, based on their years of employment, based on what was actually ascribed to be a benefit to be paid as a monthly annuity.
I know one of the most confusing things for me looking at the SERS program, and I should say that WILL is a state university and the employees here are on, for the most part, the state university retirement system. And one of the more confusing things for me is the understanding that SERS takes the place of my Social Security. When I started working for WILL and the University of Illinois in 2000, after that, I continued to get Social Security statements, and they all said your benefits earned for this year are zero. They're still coming in. They're still saying zero. So what happens if I leave the SERS system to my Social Security?
That's a great question, too. And it's a little complicated, so I'm just going to brush the surface of this. If a person has worked in the private sector and was covered by Social Security, they did indeed, if they worked 40 quarters, 10 years in the private sector, in a job that was Social Security covered, then they've earned a benefit through Social Security under the present system. The benefit that they may earn in a state plan, say, example again, SERS, when a person retires, there is what's called a coordination of benefits. Here's how it's going to work for you, Jim. You're going to lose a part of that Social Security benefit because the Social Security Administration is going to look at the fact that you're getting a benefit from an alternative plan where, as you mentioned, you've been paying into in lieu of instead of Social Security.
So does everything balance out between the two plans ultimately, even if you're no longer working for the state?
Well, balance out is kind of a difficult concept for me to wrap my arms around. Will you get as much benefit in sum from both as you would have gotten individually from each? And the answer is no.
So you'll lose out.
Well, you'll get less total as opposed to the sum of two.
Okay. Well, the sum of two, you mean one plus the other.
Correct.
Okay. But also, is there a different position in terms of how much you pay in? Is that also a factor that changes?
Again, we're just skimming the surface here, and all of the coordination of benefits gets into a lot more detail than we could cover in many hours in programming time.
For someone who's on this trajectory, who's someone who might be going into the state system and then going out of the state system. Are they going to expect a lot of paperwork ahead to essentially make sure that they are getting benefits when retirement time comes?
Well, a benefit planning process would always involve a trip to, for CSRS again, a trip to a CSRS benefit consultant. They go through all of the particulars related to the employee considering retirement or considering leaving their work and going to another employer. They do an excellent job of telling a person, here's how it works, this is what it means. The same thing would happen at the Social Security Administration office. So for a person retiring, one of the pre-planning steps is literally a visit to their office and see how that works. In this town, and I'm sure in Mattoon, Charleston, most towns like Champaign, where there is a large employee base of state employees, the Social Security local offices are very well versed in the coordination of benefits, and then they can explain that literally as it impacts the individual when they meet with them.
This is Focus, and I'm Jim Meadows. Our subject today is personal finance, and our guest is Kevin Wasby, who is a chartered financial analyst. He's a regular here every month on Focus, and he's taking your questions right now. If you have a question, general or specific, about personal finances, please call us at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter, and we're on both sites at Focus 580. We have a question that just came in on our email. If I can move it over here where I can read it. And the question is, who in the Champaign-Urbana area does fee-for-service advice for retirement? I'm 61 years old and am planning on retiring in the next few years and would like some help making decisions. I just want someone to look at our finances for a few hours instead of a lifelong contract. So perhaps the question there, Kevin, is instead of having an advisor who's going to work with you on a long-term basis and handle investments for you, who can you get just get some advice in a consultation?
That's a good question, and I would say opens up a great opportunity to talk about the different credentials that people carry. And for the question asked by this caller, I would say specifically they would probably look in their phone book and begin the process at least by looking for fee-for-services planners that are CFPs. A CFP designation stands for a certified financial planner. And that literally is an industry trade credential for people that are very well versed in looking at individuals' total financial situations. So everything from perhaps retirement and investment decision making to even the preliminary steps around estate planning. So a CFP, a certified financial planner, is one way to begin. As always, if a person knows no one in the field, I would certainly talk with friends, family members, and those that do have a working relationship with someone. Referrals are always the best way to find a professional service.
Talk to somebody who's had a good experience.
Absolutely.
You know, the phone, our switchboard is all lit up. So we're going to start taking some phone calls now. And I want to say hello to Patty in Urbana. You're on the air with Doug, Kevin Wasby on Focus.
I'm sorry to say I must respond to the discussion you had about Social Security. I am in your exact situation. I have 10 years with teacher's retirement, 10 years with CERB, and 10 years independent where my 40 quarters were recorded. The Social Security called what that is an offset, and they would never tell me how much it was going to be. When I retired, Social Security pays me a grand total of $300 a month minus $100 for Medicare. This has happened to five states that are in our situation. The rest of the country is treated, you know, they get a lot more money, so it's really inequitable that this goes on. But I just want everybody to know that it is not pretty when this happens to you.
And I appreciate that personal testimonial. As you've pointed out, your circumstance was extremely, I would call it punitive.
Yep.
It varies from person to person greatly. And as you've pointed out, it varies across the country depending upon the types of retirement plans outside of Social Security and the, how should we say, arrangements or agreements between them and Social Security. So I appreciate your call, and I think it points out ever more so that a little bit of prudence on the part of each of our, how should we say, outside of the structured retirement plan process can always be a little safety net that we could be thankful for.
That's right. But a safety net does not replace the 10 years that we put into the system and we receive nothing from it. I have relatives in other states who receive both their big retirement and big Social Security. It's not fair. And it was a political decision as usual. And I really wish that someone could do something to help us.
Well, that sounds like a real question for people in Illinois with all the problems at the pension system right now.
Right. Well, they're not interested in this because of all the other problems. Illinois and Texas are two of the states, and I don't know the name of the other three.
Okay.
And I'm so sorry to tell you that, but now you know.
Thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you.
Take care. And that does sound like it's something to be mindful of. Something I'm going to be mindful of simply as a state employee myself now. I'll have to find out more about what happens under those circumstances. I'm talking to Tom, who's on the road on I-74. Good morning. You're on the air with Kevin Waspy on Focus. And I don't have the right line for Tom. Actually, I should be talking to Rosalind in Georgetown. Excuse me, Rosalind. Are you there?
And you have me, and I am talking about the same thing that Patty just called in. I thought it was 13 states that were just among one of 13. I mean, Illinois is one among 13. She says five, so maybe some of the states have changed that. But, yes, that is true. People who work for Social Security and have hours in and those that work for the teacher system, then their Social Security is reduced even though they've paid in. And it just doesn't seem fair. Why is it that Illinois and whatever other states there are, and we have all written to our legislators and written and called and talked, and nothing is ever done about it. And I don't know what we can do about it, but it doesn't seem fair when other states get both, but we can't.
And that's the question. Is it specifically the teachers' system, or is it all of the state employees' pension systems?
I'm not sure. I'm a former teacher, so I know that it is with teachers. And I'm assuming it is with the university, the CSRS also, but I'm not sure about the state employees. I can't tell you about that one. But, we sure wish something could be done about it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rosalind, for calling in. Let's go ahead now, and let me say hello to Tom on the road at I-74. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus. Tom, are you there?
Hello.
Yes, Tom. Tom, you're on the air on Focus. I'm sorry, maybe Tom can try that call again. We weren't able to quite make a connection there. Let me say hello to Doug on Spring Bay, in Spring Bay.
Good morning.
Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
This may be a little bit off the subject, but I'll throw it out for your consideration. I heard or I saw a TV special years ago about some Pacific Islanders who used big rocks for money, and some of those rocks were actually submerged out in the ocean under the water, and nobody had seen them for 100 years, but they still used it as part of their accounting system and laid claim to it. Well, is that similar to quantitative easing, where we have money being created digitally and put into some kind of funds that we never see, and yet now we are indebted to that, and so we have huge deficits continuing, but the money is not in circulation, and it's just being used as an accounting gimmick. And I'll hang up and take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doug. I seem to remember that story, and I guess it does bring to mind the same concept. Money itself is a substitute for things of actual value that you need. When you get to the next step of using something else as a substitute for the money, are there dangers there?
Wow, we've got a great topic going here. I don't know about the Pacific Islanders. I didn't see the show, but let's talk a little bit about quantitative easing, or what the Federal Reserve is attempting to do. In a nutshell, here's how it works. The Federal Reserve has been purchasing bonds issued by the United States Treasury. In buying those bonds, the Federal Reserve is literally creating money, and that money gets credited to the sellers of the bonds. Excuse me. Most of the sellers of the bonds happen to be large banks, and the bank ends up with a credit in their Fed account. What the bank can do with those reserves now in their account is to make loans and investments. That's basically the business of commercial banks. The hopes in doing all of this is twofold. The Federal Reserve is attempting to keep interest rates very low so that the cost of borrowing incents people, businesses, so on and so forth, to borrow. The borrowed money supposedly used to expand operations, hire people, and incite growth in the economy. When we see the quantitative easing actions, or literally bond purchases, in a vacuum, we can look and say, and probably even be a little fearful over creating money that money wasn't there. A lot of people look at this and worry about the upcoming problems with inflation, with too much money chasing too few goods. The old classic definition of inflation. And that potential certainly exists with more availability of money in the system. So the supply of money has risen. Certainly reserves available to make loans and again create more money in the banking system is at all-time highs. The other side of that same coin, though, has to do with the demand for money. So now we'll talk about the velocity, or how quickly money turns through the system. And that has been the Achilles heel of this entire program from the beginning. The demand for money has not risen to meet anywhere near the supply of money. That means the price of money is very cheap. Interest rates are still at record lows. But the money is not being used to be doing the things that people would have hoped would have stimulated growth in the economy. Long story short, here we go. We're in some uncharted territories in terms of Federal Reserve monetary policy actions. Uncharted waters scare people, and they should. There's no clear way of saying how this will end. But it does get back to another item that's related but separate that the caller brought up. And that is the budgets and spending and revenues of our federal government. We are still in deficit. We are spending more than we are taking in. And again, part of this entire process is trying to get the economy to grow faster than it has been growing since the 2007-2008 Great Recession. Will I justify any or all of these actions? No. Over an adult beverage, I would have many more words of candor to share about them. But perhaps over an adult beverage sometime.
That's the invitation. Buy Kevin Wasby a drink, and you can learn more about the dangers of quantitative easing. And before we go to our break, I want to take another call, and I want to say good morning to Margaret in Urbana. You're on the air on Focus.
Hi. I have the same situation as the callers about the offset for Social Security. I'm talking on the phone and listening on the radio.
Yeah, if you can turn down your radio, that will help a lot. We do have a 10-second delay on our broadcast.
Okay.
There we are.
The same situation, the 19 years of Social Security and only getting half of it now. They call it the windfall offset. They don't want you to get too much money. But my other question is about that situation we just accept. We've tried and we can't do anything about. The other question is about the COLAs. Would you make it clear? Did you say that the COLAs, they're talking about not giving COLAs on the first $25,000 or under it? Suppose your income is below $25,000. Does that mean you will not get COLAs, or you will?
Well, I'm going by the explanation supplied by the State Journal Register. They say that the proposals would limit cost of living adjustments to pension benefits to the first $25,000 of a pension.
Okay.
But it would delay when the COLAs start. I'm not quite sure what that means, Kevin. Does that make sense to you?
Yes. this is a part of a process that's been discussed in many different House and Senate bills through all of these iterations. And what they're basically saying is, for a person who has benefits in receipt under a state retirement plan, it's only the first $25,000 of annual income that will be adjusted for inflation annually. Anything as an income from the retirement system greater than that $25,000 remains unchanged. So it's an inflation adjustment only on the first $25,000 of annual income. The other piece that's been brought up is the delay, and that has to do with the recipient's age. The age of a person eligible for retirement historically has been age 55, so they could retire and draw a life annuity at age 55 and have those cost of living increases impact their entire benefit payment every year as long as they lived. The phasing in of that will be age dependent, as I understand some of the proposed legislation. So in other words, a younger person may not be getting those cost of living increases, whereas older people will. And the ages have varied in the various proposals.
Okay, so those are some of the new variables that might exist. That's if these cost of living adjustment changes come into place, if they're approved for current employees, which is where we expect some sort of legal fight on this question. So, but it's something you'd want to be mindful of if it actually comes into play. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest today is Kevin Wasby, and he'll be back to take more of your questions on personal finance after a short break. This is Focus. And we're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and this is our monthly show on personal finance. Back with us today is Kevin Wasby, a chartered financial analyst and a lecturer at the University of Illinois College of Business, and he's ready to take more of your questions. We had a full phone bank. It's emptied out a little bit, so there's room for you to call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. Find us on either at Focus 580. That's Focus 580. The phone number is again 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's say good morning to Steve in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus with Kevin Wasby.
Good morning. Mr. Wasby, I'd like if you would discuss the impact of these pending considerations on pension changes on the economy of Champaign and Urbana. For example, if cost of living increases are capped, as you describe, that's going to have a significant increase on many of the residents, I dare say, thousands of families in the area, and therefore on the economy of the area. Other changes proposed on the cap of $113,000 for retirement would also impact the local economy, I believe, in a negative way. I'd like for you to comment on that. Thank you.
I think
Thank
that
you
is,
very much, caller.
I think that is an interesting point that doesn't get discussion. I would not be prepared to talk about the extent of the impact, because what what I would do, first of all, is I would try to suss out how many retirees actually remain in Champaign-Urbana after they leave service of the University of Illinois. Now, I know that a number of them do, but in terms of a number related to the total, I'm naive. I don't know. So that'd be the first place that I'd begin searching. The second thing that I would look into is again, if I could get some of the information as to how many, I would also look then at how many of them at what level of pension benefits. So, in other words, before I would come out with a blanket statement and say, here's how severely it would impact Champaign-Urbana, I would like to look at that first. But admittedly, it will have an impact. Anytime we see, how should we say, a policy change that changes people's disposable income, we are going to see an economic-related effect. I would also put this back to the caller and say that same statement could be made about tax policy. If taxes go up, there is an economic impact related to that. So it's, again, kind of a multi-layered onion.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about another impact, and that was the impact on the state university system last year when more people than usual decided to retire. I reported on that last year, and I remember that people, that retirees were saying, well, first of all, there's a periodic adjustment in the pension formula done at the state university level, and a lot of people found it that this was the best deal they were going to get for a few years if they retired right then. But other people were retiring because they had heard the governor say that he wanted pension reform and that pension reform was needed, and they thought that pension reform was coming, which would mean a lowering of pension benefits, and they thought that there was a chance of protection if they retired right now, if as long as they were in the window of their time to do it. I don't know if that's true or not, if pension reform is going to leave current retirees untouched. I don't know how the proposals look to you in that regard.
Well, again, there's way too many variables and way too many unknowns compared to knowns. What I would say with some amount of confidence is this. The more impact to a current retiree in retirement status. So in other words, a person who's left employment and taken an annuity as a form of distribution, a life annuity. The more attempt legislation has at a change of that, the greater the probability of lawsuits related to the state of Illinois Constitution. We go down the ladder and to the next rung, the greater the impact of any proposed change becoming an actual change in law. To a current employee who's been working under a contract of employment with these benefits as a condition, again, a little bit less probability of lawsuits, but still a high probability. as compared to cutting back an existing retiree's benefit. When we get into new hires, then we're in a totally different ballpark, because, you know, the opportunity to tell a person who has yet taken a job that when they take it, they're going to get a different retirement situation, a different retirement system, well, then that's obviously going to have very little impact to their retirement because it's a known at time of employment. Bottom line is, any changes to existing participants is probably going to trigger a lot of legal rambling.
So lots of adventures to come in that area, maybe not many definitive answers for a while. We're talking with Kevin Wasby on Focus about personal finance. I wanted to take time now, Kevin, to talk about the couch potato portfolio, which has been detailed on this show for some time now. And if you go to our website, specifically to will.illinois.edu/focus, and look up today's show, you'll find a link to an Excel document for the couch potato portfolio. And for newcomers, why don't you give a little thumbnail of what exactly this is?
Sure. The couch potato portfolio was actually a brainchild or put together by a colleague of mine, David Sinna, who used to do this show month after month after month. And David's approach to money management for individuals is, an index approach that requires little monitoring and little active engagement. So what he did was this. He looked at a variety of mutual fund families and discovered, like many do, that Vanguard is probably the most cost-effective supplier of investment vehicles for individuals. And then he chose from the literally hundreds of different Vanguard funds, eight of them, that attempt to diversify a person's money across equities, real estate, fixed income, so on and so forth. And he chose eight different mutual funds. And then those eight different mutual funds have a certain weighting, or how much of the person's money should be in each. And as David would often do, he would recommend that once a year, a person look at the mix and then, if necessary, do some rebalancing. So bottom line is, it's a way for a person to look at a strategy that requires little daily, weekly, even monthly or quarterly monitoring, because it's not meant to be a strategy that's based on what's hot now. It's meant to be a strategy that's based on long-term growth and diversification over asset classes.
So if just doing this stuff makes you nervous, this might be one way to do something and get some reasonable amount of return. Is there a trade-off? If you were working on this more actively, could you have a good chance of doing better?
I would like to say no to answer that question, because if I said yes, then I would believe in some amount of clairvoyance. Maybe I'd believe that some people were good market timers. And I think there's been enough studies done that would basically disprove those beliefs, not to a single person, but to the many that have tried. Bottom line is, it's not been... a provable belief that a person can take a lot of active interest, make active buy and sell decisions, and quote unquote beat the market.
Do people who do beat the market, are they always just lucky, or do some of them have special skills, observational powers, intuition?
Beating the market for most cases that I've seen usually means that there's a higher level of risk assumed than what would be a level of market risk. So in other words, if I wanted to accept a higher level of risk and attempt to beat the market, I might show results that do indeed beat the market. But if I adjust for that higher level of risk, I think that's where most of the academic studies are going to be pretty conclusive in saying, you know, there's probably not a tried and true way that's demonstrated itself.
If you like a higher, if you're comfortable with a higher level of risk and you actually enjoy paying attention to this, that would be one thing. But if you don't, if you're starting with, I take it, sound decisions on making your initial choices and just making sure you pay attention to what to how they're performing, you don't have to be there every hour of the day.
Absolutely. I mean, for myself, I choose individual securities. I do not do this approach for myself, but I, you know, I'm in the business of finance. I mean, that's my area. It has been my area before I came back to the university. Now I'm in the education of finance. But that's just my personal risk tolerance and my approach to it. It's a little bit like saying the mechanic that works on his own car. I mean, if your vocation is working on cars, then you may choose. You're certainly capable and able to work on your own car. I choose to do that. Mm-hmm. But for any individual that's not a mechanic, choosing to work on their own car may not be a very prudent thing to do. It may be possible for them to do it, but they may find that it's more drudgery than not taking that active approach. So long days ago, in the words of Benjamin Graham, one of the probably grandfathers of investment application, Ben Graham very easily pointed out that a person can be an active investor if that's their vocation, if that's their entertainment, or a passive investor if they don't like it, or if it's not their vocation, a passive approach. And as he pointed out, each is equally satisfying.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions about personal finance with Kevin Wasby. Call us here at 333-9455. If you're out of town, call 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Phone numbers again are 333-WILL, toll free at 800-222-WILL. We have a question, actually, from last month's program where you were here with Kimberly Cronick that we didn't have a chance to get to, but we have a chance now. My daughter will be attending college somewhere next year. I am assuming that I will need to borrow money to cover the expenses for the next 4 years. My last experience of paying for higher education was 25-plus years ago. What are my options now for borrowing money for this purpose, for college?
Well, this is a good news, bad news story. If the experience is from 25 years ago, then if you haven't already experienced sticker shock, get ready. It'll knock you over for the cost of higher education today as compared to 25 years ago. So that's the bad news. The good news, I suppose, and I'll say this with a big, 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 big asterisk for a footnote, and we'll talk about the footnote in a minute. The good news is loans available for higher education are very easy to get. I use that word with caution, but just as a generalization. There are many ways to get funding based on need. Those are grants. There are many ways to get funding for higher education, again, based on need, that are loans. And there are ways based on merit for both grants and loans. Bottom line is, accessing money for the purpose of higher education might even be a little too easy if you believe that the total outstanding amount of student loan debt in our country right now is approaching $1 trillion.
So there's access to money for doing this, but it's going to be more money than you would have needed the last compared to a quarter century ago.
It's going to be a lot more money needed rather than 25 years ago.
And the money hasn't gotten any cheaper since then, I tell you.
Access is there, but when we read the horror stories of students graduating with $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 of debt, you've got to look at that investment in education as a true investment. So last weekend, in an advising session at the College of Business for parents and incoming freshmen, I looked at both of them and I said, you need to look at this as an investment. If you think it's going to be 4 years of fun and frolic, that's a hell of an expensive vacation.
Let's go on to another caller now, and Charles in St. Joseph. Good morning. You're on the air with Kevin Wasby on Focus.
Good morning to you both. You were talking about then the investment funds. Could you tell us what the recommended funds are?
Sure. It starts out with again, these are all Vanguard funds.
Right.
The first is the 500 Index Admiral Fund. Mm-hmm. The second is U.S. Value. Mm-hmm. The third is Small Cap Index Admiral. The fourth, Small Cap Value Index Admiral.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth is Mid Cap Index Admiral.
Mm-hmm.
The sixth is REIT Index Admiral.
Mm-hmm.
The seventh is Total International Stock Index Admiral. And the eighth is Emerging Markets Stock Index Admiral.
Mm, okay. So when David set this up, he didn't set up anything in the bond area?
Not specifically bonds. I believe that within a couple of those funds, you will find some core holdings in fixed income. But you're right. None of the eight are specific fixed income funds.
I see. Okay, thanks a lot, Kevin.
You're welcome.
Great day.
Thank you very much. Let's go ahead to another caller on here, caller from Urbana, Marlene. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity. This is kind of a wild thought, but with all of the pension problems that are boiling in Springfield, I have been thinking of another aspect of our state governments and their inability to pay their other bills. I'm particularly concerned because I'm just approaching retirement age, maybe next year, plan to retire, and am beginning to incur some hospital bills. I know that the state is very behind in paying our local hospitals, and the local hospitals now are requiring us to sign contracts that say, well, you're responsible for if your insurance doesn't pay. My question is this. I'm beginning to wonder if the state is in such dire need, particularly with the SEC settlement just brought out, that that it might be good to retire early and go on to my Medicare and get my own insurance, Medigap. And because I'm afraid I'm going to run up bills and the state is not going to pay them, and I'm going to be responsible for them on my current insurance. Have you had any thoughts on that?
If I could ask a question without sounding like I'm prying, are you 65 yet?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well,
67.
Okay. Well, Medicare is already your primary insurer.
No, the university is. Medicare is my
No, when you turn 65, let me ask a dumb question. Depending on when you began working for the university, did you pay into Medicare?
Oh, yes.
At the University of Illinois?
No. I'm insured through my husband. He was privately employed. And so Medicare is our secondary at this point because he is working at the university. Medicare is actually the university. We have the university insurance, which is our primary. And then Medicare only picks up for hospitalization as a secondary.
I should know we have about 30 seconds left, Kevin.
So neither you nor he have paid into Medicare as university employees?
That's correct.
Okay. So you're in one of those, how should we say, peculiar situations?
Yes.
With the remaining time left, I would say a discussion on this topic with somebody in the financial planning area may be a good five-minute discussion.
Okay. It is complicated. Am I right? Am I getting the vibe
Bingo.
Correctly? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have right now. Kevin, thank you very much for being with us on Focus today. Kevin Wasby, our financial expert, and we expect to see you back next week, maybe with the same program host this time from month to month.
Thank you, Jim. It's always a joy being here.
We'll be back on Monday on Focus when Ed Diener, Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the U of I, will talk about happiness. This is Focus on WILL.